Hi, this is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, this is Ben. This is A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers, which hopefully you already know, otherwise you're at the wrong podcast. And my guest this week is the fantastic Alejandro Cartagena, who I will introduce properly in a second after a little bit of housekeeping and a few words from our sponsors. So do listen, because without them, there wouldn't be a podcast probably. And my voice has gone funny. I'm not very well either, so I'm a bit late this week. And so it's all a bit chaotic. I'm a bit better than I was yesterday, to be honest. But anyway, why am I telling you that? You don't care. You don't need to know. It's just like a bit of unnecessary context, really. This episode of the podcast, though, is sponsored by the independent photography magazine Loop, L-O-U-P-E. Since launching in 2016, Loop magazine has built a reputation for featuring the best in contemporary photographic talent, striving to create a platform that elevates and shares the work of emerging photographers. Loop tackles the big subjects, recognizing photography's ability to document, create, debate, and make sense of the world around us. There are two issues per year, each based around a different theme and featuring not only photographic projects exploring that theme, but commission writing on some of the subjects surrounding it. Subscribe for just £10 a year, £10 sterling, and not only will you save over 15% on the cover price, you are also qualified for a host of other extras, including exclusive access to past seasons of online content, exclusive digital access to all sold-out back issues. These are not available anywhere else. Discount code for the Loop shop and feedback on any submissions made to future issues of Loop. So go to loopmag.com, loupemag.com. To start subscribing now, and you will receive issue 11, for which the theme is belief. That's the current issue, which I have, and which is very, very good. They're all good, actually. It's a good magazine. I'm not just saying that, it really is. And it's two a year, so it's not a massive commitment. £10, that is a few cups of coffee. And issue 12 comes out later this month. So that'll be soon, March 2021. And you'll also get that one. So go to loopmag.com to check out the brilliant Loop magazine. So don't forget, there's also now an exclusive fortnightly members only episode available on the alternate Wednesdays in the month when there is no free main episode. So sign up for £5 per month at pod.fan to access that special subscriber only content, which includes the previous week's guest answering 20 bonus questions, catch ups and check ins with former guests, all the occasional specials from festivals, openings and events and more. And you can also show your support and help fund the ongoing production of this podcast by signing up just as a supporter of the show for £3 a month, which you don't get access to the member feed for, but, you know, you get my unmitigated thanks. Or you can make larger periodic, occasional and one-off donations, and you can do all that at pod.fan, where you will find the page for this podcast. If you need a new website, let me know, I'll make one with Squarespace. Oh, I can't be bothered today, to be honest. I'm going to just bang through this. Please leave me a positive review on iTunes. Anyway, this episode of the podcast, as always, is also sponsored by the brilliant Charcoal Book Club, the monthly subscription service for photo book enthusiasts that brings essential, limited edition and hard-to-find photo books to your doorstep. Working with the most respected names in contemporary photography, Charcoal Book Club selects and delivers essential photo books to a worldwide community of collectors, whether they be long-time enthusiasts with a stocked library or novices just beginning to build their collection. Join up as a member, and each month you will receive a new museum-quality first edition monograph to add to your shelves, hand-picked by Charcoal's team of expert curators and signed by the artist, along with a signed note card and an exclusive print. Sometimes the book of the month will be a classic title every bibliophile should own. Sometimes it will be a new release from an emerging artist who's poised to make big waves. They offer free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members also get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles, members-only pricing in Charcoal's online bookstore and more, all of which makes the Charcoal Book Club the best, easiest and most exciting way to stay up to date with essential work in contemporary photography. So, for instance, this week's guest, Alejandro Cartagena, his most recent book, A Small Guide to Home Ownership, is January's Book of the Month with Charcoal. You see, that's how it all works. It all fits seamlessly together. One of the reasons I'm talking to Alejandro, actually, there is a connection there because, as some of you will know, if you've been paying attention, It is the Chico Hot Springs portfolio review this month, or no, next month, April. But of course, it is unfortunately the online version because nothing's happening in situ, of course, because of COVID. So it's all happening online, remotely. And I'm talking to a whole bunch of people. And some of the results of those talks will go out on the Members Only podcast. So for you members, and for you thinking about joining up as a member, you get the benefit of that special exclusive content. All the reviewers from the Chico Review this April will be talking to me, short talks, but all will be talking to me, doing these Q&As, a bit like we do for the Members Only podcast, in the coming weeks. And that will be for the Members Only podcast. I'll also be talking to most of the speakers, the special keynote speakers who are invited to be there this year. And Alejandro is one of those people. So he's the first of the Chico Review speakers that I'm going to be talking to in the coming weeks. That full-length chat you all get to listen to. But the it's special bonus Q&A that comes after that, that is reserved for members only. I hope that's clear. Anyway, Alejandro Cartagena was born in the Dominican Republic in 1977 and lives and works in Monterrey, Mexico. His projects employ landscape and portraiture as a means to examine social, urban and environmental issues. Alejandro's work has been exhibited internationally in more than 50 group and individual exhibitions in spaces including the Cartier Foundation in Paris and the CCCB in Barcelona. And his work is in the collections of several prestigious museums, including the San Francisco MoMA, the J. Paul Getty Museum and the Museum of Contemporary Photography in Chicago, among many others. Alejandro is a self-publisher and a co-editor and has created several award-winning titles, including the aforementioned A Small Guide to Home Ownership, published by The Velvet Cell in 2020, Carpoolers, self-published with support of the Fonca Grant in 2014, Suburbia Mexicana, published by Daylight Photo Lucida in 2010. Some of his books are in the Yale University Library, the Tate Britain and the 10x10 photo books, MFH Houston book collections, among others. Alejandro has received several awards, including the International Photo Lucida Critical Mass Book Award, and the Street Photography Award at the London Photo Festival, the Lente Latino Award in Chile, the Premio y la Fotografía Award in Rome, and the Salon de la Fotografía de la Fonteca de Nuevo León, close enough, in Mexico, among others. His work has been published internationally in magazines and newspapers such as Newsweek, Nounis, Domus, the Financial Times, New York Times, Le Monde, PDN, The New Yorker, and Wallpaper, among others. So, it was a great fun. I enjoyed this chat with Alejandro. This is exactly the sort of stuff I like to do on A Small Voice, and I hope you enjoy it.
The Stoics said, the only thing that you should worry about is how you react to things.
Exactly.
Because the things that are outside of you, you can't control. I mean, you can't control how you react to them.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I've kind of brought it upon myself, you know, like it's not like I didn't want it to happen.
Exactly.
And there's lots of good things to take from it. But you know, the stress of it. I'm so glad that you started with the Stoics, though, because I'm also a big fan of the Stoics. And I was listening to your chat with Ibarinex on the Candid Frame, which was brilliant, of course, as usual. And, you know, it's always difficult because then I go, oh, no, like, oh, how can I talk to that person now that Ibarinex has done his thing? Because, you know, it was a good chat. But how did you get into Stoicism?
Divorce.
Really?
Yes.
Okay, so just walk me through that then.
That was 2017. My wife, now my girlfriend.
Oh yeah. So there's more to find out about that, but yeah, continue.
No. So it was 2017 and, you know, she dropped the bomb and it was completely heartbreaking. I was going to psychoanalysis at that moment. I had been going for at least on and off for 3 years. And I felt I was doing some kind of improvement in, you know, in myself. And then she dropped the bomb of, you know, wanting a divorce. And it really shook up my whole life. I felt that I had no ground, like, mm-hmm. everything I thought my life should be was falling apart. Everything, all the reasons why I was doing what I was doing suddenly weren't there, and they were suddenly taken as a defense of why somebody didn't love me anymore. And it was like, this doesn't make any sense. My good intentions, my work ethic and my devotion to my family, to work, suddenly were my mistakes of how I did not know how to be a husband. And it really shakes you up. And I continued in psychotherapy, but it wasn't enough. And then, I started looking for more things, and I stumbled upon the idea of Stoicism. And there, I mean, I came to it, I think, in the worst of ways. You know, you get desperate. So I was hearing stuff like other, like podcasts of how to overcome divorce, but very machista kind of things.
Yeah.
Because there is a way to get over, but it's not always the right way. But one of them mentioned the idea of thinking of how you react to what's happening. That's the only thing you can control, because your wife is like a steam train that's going in a direction, and it's going to jump off the hill. And doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter how much you change, that train is going off the hill. I mean, it's just going to the abyss.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how much you think you do to change them, or the way they think about you isn't going to change anything. The only thing that really matters is how you start thinking of yourself in that situation and how you can handle that and move forward. I mean, that took me a whole year to actually start breathing again. My whole like productive, I lost a year in production of work. I feel like I just couldn't manage it. I started getting more assistants because of that. I ended up having like 5 assistants working that year and the next year, because I would sit in front of the computer and just be numb. I couldn't answer emails. I couldn't call the framer and tell him, hey, can you frame this, or go to my printer guy and tell him what I needed to print. So I think this is from my management part of life. I used to be a manager. I in the midst of this chaos and stress, I managed to build a team that pulled off like if I was still there.
yeah, that's great.
And things didn't fall apart. They actually got even better. Had a lot of solo shows offered by the end of that, very dark period. So that really got me into when I started to breathe again. It was like, boom, I'm ready for this. I had like 4 solo shows in 2019, had 3 solo shows planned for 2020. We know how that went. Not too much happening in 2020. Yeah. But it's now I think of those bad situations as moments to understand how good life is when you don't have those situations. It's almost like I think of a Depeche Mode song about, it's called Blasphemous Rumors. And it talks about how, somebody had an accident and they died. And then they go off to sing how God There's blasphemous rumors about how God is doing all these jokes on us and how he's laughing when he puts he does these bad things to us. And I think of it that way. You know, it's if you don't see it as a joke, you know, and, you know, you have to be low to actually be high. Because how would you know that you're high if you've never tasted the low? So, but it's bittersweet, of course.
Well, it's funny because that very thing you're talking about is, you know, appreciating the good stuff is kind of what we're all in the process of experiencing because of the COVID thing. Because can you imagine, I'm just thinking about, you know, those things that one just took for granted as normal part of daily life. I mean, to be able to go back and stand in a pub, you know, outside a pub on a summer's evening in London here, and that may happen this summer. I mean, it's going to feel like that's just incredible. You know? It's like, and before you just be like, yeah, this is just what, you know, it's okay. I mean, I'm with my friends. I'm enjoying myself. You wouldn't take it as anything special, but now it would be just feel so sweet, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll see. Mm. We don't know what it's going to be to be in that situation again. Maybe we're all going to be all sad and be talking about the ones who didn't make it, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's that too.
And of course, there's a time to be away and then you move on, you know. But I'm sure once we are free to roam around the world and do what we thought was normal, at the beginning, it's going to be amazing. And then it'll be common and...
Yeah.
Whatever, again.
Yeah, we do have some very short memories.
Yeah, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And we can't, I don't think we can program ourselves, though I think the children of COVID, that is something exciting to think about. Like my two kids, how are they going to build their life with this massive hole in their life, right? Because it changed. I mean, they had a very short life. I mean, they're 7 and 8. But COVID has become such a norm and the way... I mean, my kid sometimes is more conscious about shaking people's hands and coming home and washing his hands. And like, when he sees a stranger, he automatically puts on his mask. I mean, he's like more worried than I am or more conscious than I am. So I am excited and very, I'm always living vicariously through my kids and trying to have them do things that I've never done so that I can see what their life becomes. I don't know if that's super
egocentric
of me, but, I find it exciting and at least the worst thing that could happen to a human being, which is parenthood, becomes an exciting thing, you know, because that is something that I do believe. Parenthood is the most difficult thing you can bear and the most hurtful, but it is a very beautiful thing at the same time. It's a permanent shithole and a permanent place of wonder and discovery.
But it's so unusual for someone to express that with such honesty, Alejandro, because most people tend to view it through rose-tinted spectacles, to say the least. And you're right, it can be just brutal and really fucking hard, you know.
It's super hard. I mean, I remember talking to Christina, my ex-wife, girlfriend. When we had Fausto, and we were like, why didn't people tell us that this is so fucking hard and this is so miserable and that you feel like shit every single day? What the hell?
There's a conspiracy of silence around the thing.
I mean, yes, we need to, you know, perpetuate humanity, you know, that is in our genes. We can't, you know, are we attracted to people, or is it just, you know, our genes wanting to reproduce because that's the code, that's the way the code works?
Yeah. Yeah, it's like my buddy said to me, you know, we were talking about this once, and he just said, we're just animals, Ben. You know, fundamentally, we're just animals. That's why we reproduce, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've got big brains and stuff, but we're still at the mercy of our kind of most primal urges.
Yeah,
but,
for sure.
But it feels like it's just to hear someone else kind of say that, you know, when you are a parent and you do kind of suffer sometimes, it just feels good to know that you're not the only one who thinks that way.
Oh. And I have amazing time with my kids. I mean, the conversations are mind-blowing sometimes. And then they're the most simplest of things. Like last night, going to sleep with Fausto, he's like, think of your favorite superhero and combine it with another superhero. And he's like, and he said, okay, I'll give you the superhero. And he says, Captain America. I'm like, okay, Captain America. And I'm thinking, how can I impress this kid? And then I think, okay, he has this shield that's made of vibranium. So vibranium, oh, Black Panther, because he's like the vibranium character. No, everything is around vibranium. So I tell him, Captain America with Black Panther, and his eyes just they glow of excitement because I'm in the flow with him.
Yeah, it's like just, you really thought about it. You didn't like just you really thought about your answer properly. It's totally getting into the spirit of it. Like,
exactly, you know. And it was so exciting. And then that's the first part. And then, you know, trying to tell him my point of the vibranium, and he's like, "Oh my god!" And then he's like, and then there's silence, and I see his eyes glowing, and he's like, "Captain Panther." Panther America, American Panther. And he's like, which one is the best, Dad? Which one is the best? I can't remember which one he it was Captain Panther or American Panther. I don't know. He came to one. He's like, yes, that's the one, you know?
Yeah.
And that's it. And then it's like, good night. Bye. See you tomorrow. And that was it.
Yeah, those are the moments. Those are the moments that make it really worthwhile. But like you say, you know, I think my cousin said to me, it's heaven and it's hell, you know, that's as close a description, you know, it's as good a description as you can get, because it can be both those extremes.
And I think we should be honest with parenthood and speak about the trouble of parenthood, because I mean, are we not in this earth to be more conscious of who we are? And if we don't believe in these struggles, in what's supposed to be the most beautiful thing, then we're gonna live our life in half, because we're gonna deny pain when it's there. It's like you cannot avoid that pain. It's right there in front of you. So I think it's humbling. It makes you more vulnerable, and you're more honest with your life. And I don't know. I think those are values, and I'm not this moralist person, but I think those are values that are exciting, because they have nuance, and they show you different parts of life. And you can bring that to your work. I think I bring that to my work too. So I'm guessing all the time, you know. I'm guessing that maybe this project is good. I'm guessing that maybe this book is going to be good. I'm guessing that the way I edit is okay. I'm always guessing, as I am guessing my parenthood, you know.
Well, yeah, it'll get you get used to not knowing what the hell you're doing, because that's the kind of default. So that's actually having that sort of beginner's mindset, which, you know, is sometimes important to the creative process. But the stoicism thing, that thing of sort of understanding that, like you say, you can change how you react to something rather than necessarily change that thing, it's such a simple principle, but it's so hard. So few people actually stop to take it on.
Yeah, I think I mean, some of the Stoics said you can't reach that, you know, that point where you live that way. Mm-hmm. But, and I believe that the my take on it, it's so simple. It's so complicated at the same time. For me, it was the discovery of that philosophy, of that idea, has been amazing, you know. Mm. Just the knowing of it. It's almost like there's something about language. Some languages don't carry some words because they just don't see the world that way. So there's no word to explain that feeling, because that feeling in that culture doesn't exist. You know?
Right. Yeah.
So for me, I took it as that. Suddenly I was able to include in my language the idea of Stoicism. And that is the first part, the first step, you know, acknowledging that there is a possible way of how to deal with hurt. And that's all you can do. You can't, I mean, there's so many things happening in life, parenthood, relationships, disease, pandemics, work. I mean, there's so many things that, can you really stop and think exactly how the Stoics thought? I mean, there's a complete desfase. I don't know how you say that in English, but the way life was lived when they were present has nothing to do with the way we live life right now. And so you have to take that into account and not suffer from trying to be better understanding of hurt, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it would be, I mean, it's a double worry, a double failure in a way. So do it. I mean, just have it present. I think that's the best we can do at this moment.
Well, I mean, because with the divorce thing, it sounds like, you know, it's a classic example of, you know, kind of work life, professional life was probably going pretty well.
Yeah.
While your sort of personal life was kind of falling apart without you even possibly being aware of it or noticing. It sounds like it came out of the blue to some extent.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds so ridiculous for that to happen, but it comes, I mean, and this is what I understood through psychoanalysis, is that you are inside a paradigm, several paradigms at the same time. I was living my familial paradigm, my first paradigm, which is my mother and father, both workaholics, they're still married, but always have had, you know, a struggle as a couple. And so I was reproducing that paradigm of being a workaholic and having a struggle with my wife. And I saw nothing wrong of it, because this was the paradigm that made me exist as a human being. So who am I to question the paradigm that made me the person I am? It's so complicated to see it that way.
And to sort of step outside of all of that and to have enough self-awareness to sort of see it, you know, kind of objectively, or see your own behavior objectively.
Impossible. Impossible. That's why psychotherapy works, because you're spitting out these words and there is a mirror, in this case, the therapist, who's not telling you their personal points on your problems. They're just rephrasing back what you just said, maybe in a clearer way. And when you hear that echo of yourself, you can hear yourself from the outside. And it's like, oh my God, what am I doing? Who am I? Like, it was, I'm getting chills of thinking about it. It's like, suddenly I looked up and I was like, who am I doing this for? Why am I working so much for? Like, am I trying to please my parents' paradigm? Why am I staying in this marriage if it's not working? Is the family paradigm that I'm supposed to fulfill? I mean, there were so many things on top of me that I never asked for, and that I was acting for them. And when I said, no, I am going to reconstruct my own paradigms, because you can't be out of paradigms. Mm. But the best you can do is decide, okay, I am going to be in this set of paradigms. And, you know, and that decision changes your life, you know, because it's, okay, I'm going to accept that I am going to be a middle-class person in a very fucked up country where there is violence for men and for women, more for women, and there is insecurity, and the way that I'm supposed to live my life is this way. Okay, okay, I see. Do I want to do this? Yes, no, yes? Okay, let's do it. But I took the decision. I think, of course, I'm in another paradigm that I can't even see. But at least I have a small sensation that now I've decided to be the partner that I think I can be, and not what I should be. And I think of Winnicott. He's a psychologist from the 20th century, and he has this phrase, mainly for parenthood, but I feel it for like life, and it's good enough. You know, just be as good enough as you can. And that's great, you know? And that's the good, that's a place to be. And
That's comforting when it comes to, certainly when it comes to parenting, you know, that's as much as you need to aspire to in a way.
Because you're, you know, and then the accepting of how my parents fucked me up, you know, and I'm going to do something to my kids that is the cycle that we all live in, where I need to understand and blame what my parents did to me. And that's entre comillas. I don't know how you say that in English. They didn't do anything, you know, they were just there. They were doing what they thought they were supposed to do. But that just taking into account that it doesn't matter how good or how great you think you are as a parent, your kids are going to come back and blame you for stuff. That is the cycle of life. Yeah. And that is fine. So if you just take it to good enough, when they come back, because they're going to come back and they're going to tell you all the bad things that you did to them, you'll be okay with that, because you're not going to be frustrated because you sacrificed your life with trying to do all these great things and then they're ungrateful with all your efforts. I think it's so such a sad thing to aspire that, you know, and it's going to happen. So why try to be the greatest parent ever when, you know, that it's going to mean nothing for your child in the end?
Yeah. And you're setting yourself an impossible standard to, but something must have worked. If your ex-wife is now your girlfriend, all I can say, Alejandro, is something definitely worked. Was it the adoption of these philosophies must have had a positive impact?
Yeah, I mean, it was. I acknowledged all the wrongdoings that I did, and before, let's put it this way: before I knew I was doing, I didn't know I was doing wrong things. You know, being machista or being whatever I was that drew her away from me. And when I started psychotherapy and I understood that I was doing that, my first approach to her was, I know I'm doing this thing. Give me an opportunity. I'm going to change. Mm. And it didn't work. And then a year after our divorce and we were living separate lives, when we talked again, and it was more of, I'm sorry for the things I did. I did not know I was doing them, but I know how much they hurt you. That changed everything. Because first it was, I didn't know I was doing them, sorry, but not acknowledging that I did them, you know?
Yeah.
And then the second part was, I know how I drew you away and I destroyed the relationship, and I assume that, and I'm sorry for that.
So you owned it, basically.
Yes. In basic terms, exactly.
Yeah,
but it's it takes a year or 2 years or maybe a lifetime to own things, because it's subtle things that make you change your mind. It's not a decision. It's a process, and being open to listening to different ways of how to see life and how to see parenthood and how to see who you are as a man, who you are as a privileged person. I mean, just being thirsty, I think, is important. Like today, I started my assistant / editor of almost 10 years put me into podcasts about poetry. And I am so excited. Oh my God, the way poets talk about their poetry is exhilarating, amazing, amazing. It's like they know exactly how form and theme go together and create what they're looking for. And when and I guess I'm always thinking of photography and how to bring in things that make me better understand what I'm doing, because like I told you, I'm guessing a lot of things all the time. So suddenly when you hear another art that has their shit together, it's like, oh wait a minute, I can also think of photography this way, I can also approach it this way. Not that it's gonna be like I'm going to do poetry with photographs. It's not about that. It's the process of knowing what you're doing and finding words to describe that so that you can evolve. Because if you're, if there isn't a reflexión, I don't know how you say that. A reflection. No, you don't say reflection, a reasoning or a questioning of why you did that you guessed, in the end, there's no evolution. You always stay in the same, and you're going to do the same projects over and over again with the same idea, because at the end of it, you weren't capable of asking, how did I use the placement on the page? How did I use texture? How did I use scale? How did I use rhythm? How did I use similarities? How did you use form to say what you wanted to say?
Mm-mm.
And
yeah, it's about this kind of having this kind of toolbox at your disposal of different things, and the poet has that like any other artist. And I think there are similarities. The thing about poetry is that it's this kind of distillation, isn't it, of this beautiful, you know, language.
Yeah.
And I think photography is also a lot about distillation as well. I mean, editing is distilling,
that's
you know,
true,
a large number of images down to a smaller number. And even within the single image, you know, the distillation of what can I remove here? You know, maybe less is more to some extent. I don't know.
Interesting. I'm just getting into this idea of thinking of poetry. I used to be an avid reader of poetry before I got into photography. But only never thought of it as a form or to think of how it works. You know, I was just consuming it. And it's a completely different perspective. So what's exciting me is the idea of how poets talk about it and reason the decisions behind the use of words, the questions that appear in their poems, or other people's poems. So that's what's exciting me.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you are someone who sort of does just borrow kind of inspiration from all kinds of different places. I can imagine, you know, the poetry is sort of going to be sitting there in the back of your head, and eventually it's going to somehow appear as some kind of influence in your work.
For sure.
I mean, this period of of unhappiness, because people talk about divorce as being, you know, it's universally acknowledged to be an incredibly emotionally, you know, tumultuous thing to have to go through. But it did sort of get reflected in you started vandalizing, I think is the word that you used. You started vandalizing images. This was a very, a kind of fairly big departure from everything you'd done up to now, but that came about in a way from this period, right?
Yeah. I mean, it is a departure in the way the finished work, but it is about who I am and how I learned photography, which was through the archive. I mean, I learned photography by working in a photography archive, scanning other people's works, printing those works, curating those works, writing about those works, framing those works, designing exhibitions for those works. And that was my first entry point was through looking at the archive. So when I went back, when I started buying archive images and collecting them, at first it was just admiration for old photographs and the possibilities of the archive and what's contained there that isn't being talked about. But when I started to think I can use this to say something, apart from just, you know, curating and putting things together that kind of make sense, but more of how do I make that's there into something that I did. So yes, it's a departure again visually, but it has to do with archive. It has to do with what taught me what photography is. Mm. So I can't shake that off me. I mean, it was 5 years of scanning photographs every single day. I mean, I scanned things from the 19th century, 20th century, glass plates, 35 mil. I mean, everything. I had the opportunity to scan the whole work of a photographer from his first days of photographing at the beginning of the 20th century, 1906, 07, up to the 1970s when he stopped photographing. That is an amazing opportunity to think of how to learn photography. Mm. You see an evolution of visual language, of somebody's understanding of how to translate reality into a two-dimensional form. And that really informed my work a lot. And I think I'm striving for that. You know, I'm striving for having this evolution in my form, evolution in the way I see the world, questioning the way I see the way I photograph and the way I see. And that work is precisely that. Okay, I'm going to take images that, you know, they belong to me, but I didn't take them. And I'm going to make them do things that they weren't intended to do. And I think that's really, really interesting and exciting. And it all started with a project where I decided to include photographs of the past because I can't photograph the past. So I wanted to do a sort of timeline and make that a timeline transformed into a book. That was the premise, right? How do you do that? You know, if span 100 years, how can I expand? I don't even have 100 years. So it was the archive that was, so I went back to the archive I worked at and I told them, hey, can I use photographs that I scanned? I know that they're there, you know, I saw them and I had taken photographs of those subject matters. I mean, I do these interviews and I think of all my work is based on all those images I scanned. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't let go of it because I didn't have, I didn't go to university. I learned.
Well, you're almost like the poster boy for the idea of learning about photography mm-hmm. through looking at other photographers. Yeah. And the advice is so often repeated that, you know, for young photographers to look at other people's work. You've got to look at other people's work. But you had that as your day job, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Looking at other people's, I couldn't do anything else. That was, and it was, I mean, talk about inspiration, talk about being excited to go to work, you know, because sometimes we had archives that everybody was excited about in the office, right? That like we scanned some images of Guillermo Kahlo. He's the father of Frida Kahlo. He was an amazing photographer, architect.
Oh,
and I don't know how those images got to the photography center, but they're 8x10s and 11x14 direct contact prints.
Contact from a massive neg, yeah.
Oh my God, what an amazing opportunity to see those images. It was mind-blowing, so yeah.
So, but then like you were you starting to shoot around the same sort of time that you had that day job at the archive? Because I think it was sort of I don't know, mid 2000s, and you started working on this kind of exploration of the suburbs around where you live, which is in Monterey.
Yeah, I mean, I started working in the archive because I wanted to be a photographer. I mean,
right. That you'd already decided.
Yeah. I had been working in the service industry I started working in restaurants when I was 15, and I stopped working in restaurants when I was 27. So that's 12 years of working in restaurants, cafeterias, hotels. And I was pretty much done with that. I didn't want to do that anymore.
But just during that period, just to interrupt, as someone who's clearly, or certainly is now, you know, a sort of profoundly creative person, was there frustration there? Did you know in your heart that there was something massive missing from your life, i.e., you know, the creative process? Or did you just, I guess people, you know, sort of justify these things to themselves and, you know, you got a job and there's nothing too wrong with that and all this other stuff.
No. I studied leisure management, but I also went to music school. So I was doing a major in leisure management and a major in music at the same time. So for six semesters, I was studying music. So there was I was in a band. Like I had this creative thing flowing in me. I was a skateboarder, and skateboarding is about being creative. You know, tricks and, you know, risking your life and making cool things and making videos of that. I mean, it was there. But life just led me to the service industry. But at that time when I was very much in the service industry, that's when I was reading a lot of poetry. I was reading a lot, because I was in buses going to the suburbs, which were where most of the restaurants I was working at. So I lived in one suburb and drove on a bus and the metro for an hour and a half. So I had a lot of time of reading time and writing a lot of poetry at that time. They're all in a bag here in the archive. I think they're shit, but you know, at some point somebody will find them and laugh at me. At the stuff
I wouldn't be so sure. You don't know that at all.
But anyways, so there was always something there. And I think I got inclined with photography, and this is what I think drew me to photography. And it was that when I moved from Dominican Republic to Mexico when I was 13, out of the blue, in the sense that there was no go away party for us from the family, from friends. It was like we had a ticket. We're moving. That's it. I think it was so hurtful for my parents that they didn't want to do more to announce that they were leaving. And then there was something weird with my dad's job. Like my best friend's dad was my father's boss. And he, like, after we had all left the Dominican Republic, my friend's dad, like, told my dad, bring them back. You know, we'll give them scholarships. We'll send them to the U.S. because that's what happened in that. Like, most of my friends went to the U.S. on golf scholarships or tennis scholarships. I used to play golf. I used to play baseball. That was my life. I was a sport kid. And then, so that was kind of weird to leave like that. And so the, and all that, I tell you all this because it was a really beautiful life in my mind, right? Memory is weird sometimes, but I thought I had a beautiful life, and the photo album was my soothing place, you know? And I saw my photo albums. I would go back to them over and over again for 2 years until I got into high school and I became the cool kid because I talked weird and I was from very far away. But before that, in junior high, I was the weird kid who talked strange and who was not friends with anybody.
Right. So you were the same kid both times. It's just the reaction was different.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. High school was better because everybody came from different places. So I was the one who came from furthest away, a different country, a different culture. I knew how to dance merengue and salsa. I mean, it was like, oh, this is, I ended up being like the class president of the high school. I mean, it was amazing. I got into a rock band. I mean, it was.
So that's that's the crucial difference between seeing difference as some kind of, threatening thing.
Exactly.
And seeing difference as something to be celebrated.
Exactly.
Right?
I lived through that in a span of 3 years, teenager. So that experience of going to the photo album, those first years here in Mexico, I think grounded it planted the seed of me becoming a photographer, because now I see what I was looking for. I was looking for solace and comfort in images that were telling me or confirming a story that I think I lived because I was a kid, and those images were, I mean, I was 5, 6, 7 in a lot of those images. I don't remember that. So the photograph kind of let me perpetuate a little bit longer my Dominican self, which was a safe place. And high school kind of let me shed that identity off. Mm-hmm. And of course that, It never went away in reality. You know, I'm always from here and from there at the same time. And then I'm married to an American, and, you know, it's another culture. And I've always, like, I speak American because I've always lived close to the U.S. I went to an only English speaking school when I was in DR. My godparents are from Puerto Rico, English speaking Puerto Ricans. I mean, it was like, I don't know, a mixed match of cultures happening at the same time. And that plus the trauma and the solace from those photo albums helped, you know, me become a photographer. And I had a crisis in 2016 where I started to question that if I wouldn't have had a workshop, a photography workshop in 2004, where it was analyzing photographs, I think it was the name of the workshop. It wasn't about doing photographs. It was about analyzing photographs. If I would have gone to like a sculpture workshop or a painting workshop, I would not be in photography, you know, because that was my crisis. I was like, what am I doing in photography? You know, I have all these ideas and all these demons in my mind. Does it really matter that I'm taking photographs? I mean, I have so much to say. It's just that the first thing that was put in front of me and really excited me was photography. So I had a moment where I thought, you know what, maybe I should do a master's in fine arts and explore other things. And then I was like, no, you know what? I love photography and I understand the language, and yeah. And I stayed here.
You having a crisis because you kind of felt that it was all a bit arbitrary that you'd ended up doing photography.
Exactly. Could,
like you say, in a different workshop. But then that's just a reflection of life. You know, we all get taken down these paths for all kinds of weird arbitrary reasons. But clearly, you know, yeah, like you say, you did take to photography as a medium.
Yeah. And I'm here because I have something to say. And I do photography because I can't let go of all the things I want to say. And it's not about anything else. Like somebody asked me before, what do you feel when somebody sees your work or something like that? And I'm like, you know, I do my work for myself. I mean, that is what I strive for that high of the possibility of noticing that demon in my mind, processing it, making it into a body of work, putting it out in the world as a book, as exhibition or whatever, and understanding that I was strong and brave enough to do something about it. That's all I want to do, you know, over and over again until I die. That's what excites me as a creator.
You are sort of notably productive, I must admit. You know, I know you've been at it a while, but just looking at your website and looking through all the different projects and going, my God, Alejandro really gets shit done here, man. It's like he's, you know. And you just did a book called A Small Guide to Home Ownership.
Yes.
Which I should have here because the good old Charcoal Book Club had it as their book of the month. But sadly, things have been delayed in the mail, so
I still
have not received it. Otherwise, I'd be actually, but I've at least had a chance to look at it, you know, sort of remotely. But that amalgamates many years of work, because the thing that I sort of alluded to a minute ago, which was the kind of work that you shot about the suburbs mm-hmm. around Monterey, was one of the things that you started doing back in the day in sort of 2005, and then. You know, how did you come to the decision to then 15 years later sort of amalgamate a whole bunch of things into that particular project?
It was a solo exhibition in the Museum of Modern Art in Dominican Republic. They invited me to do a show there. It was going to be a really big show. And I started to think, what have I done? You know, it's not a retrospective at all. It was, you know, a project-based exhibition. And when reviewing my work, I mean, by that time I had at least 10 years into photographing things that had to do with urbanism, suburbs. And I don't know, I can't remember, I can't pinpoint how I came to the word home ownership, but I guess it was something I was reading at that time. But that when I found that word, I saw how that united all the projects that I had done up to then. It was like home ownership sparks all these projects. It sparks the idea of bureaucracy of home ownership and the mortgage process and the bank loans, and I had photographed that. It sparks the idea of transportation from the outskirts to the inside of the city. It is the propagandistic idea of home ownership that makes people take decisions of going to a place where there's no bus system and then finding, you know, colleagues to drive in the back of a truck and risk their lives to go to work. You know, it is the idea of home ownership that makes them do that.
Right. It's such a kind of powerful fantasy.
Yes.
That, you know, any other considerations sort of tend to fall by the wayside.
Exactly.
even though it doesn't actually make any sense.
Exactly. Exactly. It's like, I see it as the steps of falling in love, right? And I see it very specifically for home ownership in Mexico. It's a new concept in a way for middle class working people and blue collar, you know, communities that have never owned a house. You know, it's their first interaction with home ownership and your first interaction with your, you know, the person you like, everything is beautiful. You don't see any of the faults, you know, you don't hear their farts. You don't hear how they, you know, how they burp. You don't hear anything. You just see love. So Mexico, I think, is in that first stage. Well, we're kind of falling to the second stage where you question if you really love the person, right? If you really love the idea of homeownership, because it's making you suffer, you know. But at the first part, the beginning of the 21st century, I mean, there was such a massive propaganda system to have people believe that home ownership was the opportunity of their lives to become socially, to have that social possibility of escalating up, right? That was the only way to progress.
That's sort of being imported from the US, basically, as far as Mexico goes. Yeah,
I mean, the idealization definitely is important from the US. The model, it was taken from different places. There were some models from Chile that were taken in the form the houses were being built and the scheme of how they were going to do the whole thing. They took from many places. But it ended up being a perfect system where, you as a worker, you get points, you get awarded points because you're working, and those points are put there because money is being put into a system by your boss or the business you work for. And it's all in the background. So magically, you have, I can't remember what the minimum points is. You have 1,000 points and you are eligible to own a house and to get a loan to own a house. So there is a magical thing to it. It's not like you saved up money. It's like there's points that grant you the opportunity to become a homeowner.
Right. Yeah. So it's sort of been handed this kind of golden ticket.
Exactly. I mean, it's perfectly done. And then it's contrived with the developers so that what do developers do? They find the cheapest land. Where is the cheapest land? The furthest away from, you know, the infrastructure that's already built. And they sell you a house for an insane amount of money that doesn't correspond with what you're getting, because you're not going to get electricity in the first maybe year that you have. You're not going to get gas. You're not going to get water. Everything is, let's see how you manage, right? If you pay more, of course, you do get houses that are in the grid. But a lot of people just want the house because they've been fed this golden ticket, like you say. Mm. So how am I not going to take it, you know?
And I mean, this is, it kind of reminds me of the whole kind of basis of the big crash in 2008 or when it was, you know, which is all basically perpetuated by, you know, this kind of mortgage clusterfuck high risk. And
there's an opportunity. Why won't you take it? They're giving loans.
I mean, so, and I was a classic example of one of those people who benefited from that insanity, because I would not have been able to probably get a mortgage because I was, you know, a skint photographer. I still am a skint photographer. And I didn't think there was anything weird about the fact that they were just going, oh, just tell us how much you earn. You don't have to, like, just, you know, the old liar's loan, as they refer to them. Because I was like, oh, I just say 80 grand a year then, do I? Yep, just write it in there and, you know. And I was like, okay, lovely. I'll do that. And that, it wasn't till years later that I suddenly realized, oh, my God, I was part of that problem in a way, at least I wasn't one of the people who lost out.
Yeah,
I don't know if you've read The Big Short or if you've seen the movie.
I saw the movie. Yeah, for sure.
Fantastic. It really explains everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
But
go ahead.
No, I mean, I was just to bring it back to your projects, because these extraordinary little sort of suburban towns with these little boxes, these little coloured houses. I presume, I mean, that was, as you know, you knew the suburbs, so those are places that you're just very much aware of if you live there, right?
Yeah, for sure.
what drew you to explore that though, and what fascinated you by those places?
I mean, there are several ways of how I got there. The first was inspiration, because the photographs that I was scanning at that moment is of this photographer I was telling you about, Eugenio Espino Barros, that I scanned his whole body of work. And he was a master landscape photographer and architect photographer. So sure enough, what did I do? I went out and I bought a medium format camera, a large format camera, and I started to photograph landscapes and cityscapes. And it was that. And then a touch of luck that Wendy Watrous, she's the director or the founder of PhotoFest in Houston. She came here to the photography center as a judge for a competition. And I was her tour guide of the city. And for 2 days, we talked and talked and talked. And at the end, she's like, oh, and do you do photographs? I'm like, yeah. And can you show me? And I'm, yeah. And I was taking these photographs and I showed her these images I had printed out. And she's like, oh, these remind me so much of the new topographics from the 1970s and 60s. I'm like, what? And I'm like, yeah, these photographers, you know, they kind of started documenting urban expansion in the U.S. And I'm like, wow, oh my God. And I that made me aware of that I was photographing what was there. Everybody saw those houses. It's just that I didn't see it as a subject matter at that time. And then the other entry point to that project was that my family is from a suburb called Juarez, and that suburb went from being a 60,000 people suburb at the beginning of the 1990s to more than 500,000 now. And it just grew exponentially, and with no policing. I mean, and that's a subject in itself. And a lot of the land of those of the houses that I was photographing and eventually photographed were of my family, but we didn't even know. They were stolen from my great-great-grandfather through a notary public and a drug cartel. So,
right.
So there was a personal connection to photograph the people who were inhabiting some of the lands that belonged to my family that we didn't even know, right? That when we figured out that those lands belonged to us, it was too late. It was a lawyer. He came and said, are you family member of such and such and such person? Yeah, we're like, everybody's like, yeah. So these are lands that used to belong to your great-great-grandfather, but they're lost. You know, don't even do anything about it. You know, there's people who have taken care of that, and you're not too look for those lands anymore. So that serendipitous opportunity of meeting Wendy Rathris and making a reference to my work to the new topographics and that personal connection kind of made me, you know, as a photographer, you have to find these little weird things that make you believe that you're doing something that's worthwhile. And
well, you sort of became aware of the fact that in a way you were continuing a tradition in a way, you know, that you were sort of part of this, established tradition.
Exactly. So yeah. I didn't mention this before, but when I started photography, it was 2004, I became obsessed with the idea of the history of photography. And I was reading a lot and just trying to understand this thing that somebody in a workshop told me, you can live a photography and there are people interested in looking at work about what you think of the world. I was like, what? Are you for real? This, are you like, and that was workshop about analyzing photographs. And he showed me all these artists that, you know, do photography. And I was like, he's not shitting me. This is for real. And yeah, and that evolved into a very conscious project. Then I became fascinated with the whole idea of the new topographics. And then there was a parallel in the archive that I was scanning of people photographing the landscapes that I was living in now as in the 21st century. So it's a combination of now what am I going to say about those places that I inhabit, that I'm scanning, and what am I, how am I going to connect to the history of photography without being reiterativo, I don't know, repetitive, and what is my proposition to the problem of suburbanization? So that's when the like the project became a little bit more complex. It's not only visualizing houses being built. It's about, well, how do those houses get built? Well, there's a bureaucratic process for those houses to be built. So let's go photograph the housing commission in Monterey. And I spent 2 years photographing inside the building where people get their points and, you know, and they get their subsidies to have their house. I also then went, what happens to the ecological, you know, to the to nature around these buildings? And of course, we have water scarcity here in this state. So there's a lot of dams. So there's a lot of streams and rivers that are dead all over the place. So let's photograph that. What happens to downtown when there's so much growth to the outside? It dies. It dies out. So downtown here in Monterey became a lot of crime. A lot of beheadings were happening here. I mean, sounds fucking weird, but yes, happening here downtown. And then a lot of houses were being torn down. So I thought, holy shit, there's a connection between, for there to be growth, there has to be destruction, right? And then I went into a master's degree in visual studies, and suddenly it's about not doing art, but understanding why art is art. So it became for me this discovery of how documentary photography is about putting as much as many voices at the same time together. At least contemporary documentary photography is not anybody can go out and picture a subject, but can you delve into why that subject exists everybody sees the problem. What you don't see is why that problem is there. And that's mm-mm. kind of what I was trying to do. You know, the bureaucracy behind, I mean, is the bureaucracy what builds the houses? Is it the dreams of people that build the houses? So, okay, if it's the dreams, let's find a dreamer. So at that moment, my brother had been renting for like 4 years and he was in the process of buying one of these small houses. So I'm like, hey, can I follow you in your path to become a homeowner? So I went to his loan meetings. I went to everything that he was doing to get a house. He finally got his loan. And then I told him, hey, can I have all your images from your cell phone? Because he was documenting it from his point of view. And then I moved in with him for the first few days of being a homeowner. And I wanted to see if there was a change. I photographed them when they were a renter, when they were renters, and then when they became homeowners. What does that look like? That is landscape too. You know, those emotions are also about what changes the landscape. Those dreams change. So I tried to, and I'm still doing that, you know, I'm trying to find ways in how to put voices to dialogue with each other, contradict each other, but it's what it's doing, I hope, is offering an opportunity to the viewer of how I am suspect of what of my own practice. Mm-hmm. I don't have the truth. I'm guessing. You know,
you talk about the sort of, I think you refer to the collision of ideas within the same project, you know, and that being a kind of poetic thing. That's how you feel about that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there's nothing new about documentary photography. You just take pictures of what's there, you know, but the opportunity of making it poetic or lyrical is to confront ideas that weren't meant to be seen with each other. And that's what's exciting for me sometimes, you know. Not all the projects have those layers, but the ones that have formed the way I think about photography are those, you know, how can I put as much layers possible? And the guide to home ownership is exactly that, you know, it's this propaganda rhetoric in the bottom and it's noise always bubbling through words. And on top of that is the a possible reality of what home ownership looks in a country that copy pastes a culture, an ideal, a dream.
Yeah. Well, we should sort of say something about how you put the book together, because people can find the little preview images online, not the same as having the actual book in your hand, but you did it as a sort of almost as a kind of parody of a dummy's guide or something, you know, it's almost like a dummy's guide to home ownership. In fact, you could have easily called it that, but maybe you would have got sued or something.
Exactly. I took the design, but not the name.
Tell me a little bit about how that kind of came about, that sort of concept, or how you sort of brought it to fruition.
It was, I mean, I did that exhibition. I did an exhibition called A Small Guide to Home Ownership in the Museum of Modern Art in Santo Domingo. And then I showed that work in the Museum of the Americas in Washington, D.C. So I fell in love with the idea. But then how could I make that into a book? And it took 5 years, 2 years of thinking and then coming to a critical mass moment where it was like, this is how it's going to be. And then just going forward. And I think it started with understanding that it was going to be really complicated to mix all these different photographic styles. There was black and white, there was large format, medium format, 35 millimeter, cell phone. I mean, there was so many. How do I create this contraption that is going to let everything dialogue with each other? And so the book, a book, that's the first step. And then I had the idea of home ownership, and the exhibitions had been done. And so I started to read about home ownership. And a lot of the stuff that is there out there about home ownership are guides to home ownership. You know, these very specific step guides of how to become a homeowner, especially in the US. I mean, there's such a massive system of home ownership and real estate in the US that everything has been written about how to buy a house. So I thought, I'm going to buy all these things and I'm going to read them and see how I feel. And of course, they were disgusting in that, you know, it's so contrived, and it works in a way that it can only work for certain people. And so I felt, I was disgusted, but then I was interested also with the idea that is what happened here in Mexico and what happens in a lot of countries. You have this idealization of the idea, but then there's what's really happening. There it is. Let's make that. Let's put those two together and see what happens. And so at that moment, Fernando, my editor, he started teaching in university and he had assistants, and he's like, I have this guy. I don't know what to do with him. And he's like, I had the guides and I had the ideas. We had like talked about them, and I'm like, why don't we get him to scan every book and just spread them out in the studio and see what happens? So we did that. We put them in the wall, and then we printed out like 600 pictures from like, I think it's like 12 projects. And let's put them on top of the pages and see what happens. And that was a process of 3 years.
Wow, 3 years of it, yeah.
Refining and refining and taking out, oh, no, this is too much, this is too much, this is too much. And eventually they kind of worked, you know. I let a lot of freedom with Fernando to like cut. And then there was a moment where I like understood what he was trying to say with the way he was editing and sequencing. that it was like, okay, I grab it. And then it was selecting images. So he had some images, and then I had some preferred images that I wanted to use. And then it was like, okay, let's work on that. And yeah. And then, there was a publisher that got interested in the book, and then they said, no, we couldn't fund it. So I already had like this 120 page dummy. And then I pitched it to the Velvet Cell, and they were like, automatically, yes, we want it.
Yeah.
And
that's very much, I know Ayn has been on the podcast a while back, in fact, and that's very much in his wheelhouse, yeah, you know, that
exactly.
subject matter.
Yeah.
So you can see it's a perfect match.
It was a perfect match, yeah. But
you've also done a fair bit of self-publishing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I like both. I mean, I guess I've grown enough as a editor, designer, photographer, that I've gained the trust of publishers, so that when I co-publish with an editor or let them publish, I still get the same freedom as if I'm self-publishing. I think now I'm going to do more self-published books that are like quick. They're like pop songs, not, you know, symphonies. You know, they're more immediate. Like,
oh, that's a nice idea, yeah. Because not everything has to be some kind of magnum opus,
No.
I think there's a lot of preciousness around when people are, you know, especially when, you can understand it, people are doing their first mm-hmm. photo book especially, and it feels like this kind of special thing,
yeah,
you know, and
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like, ah, fuck.
Yeah, I mean, you can grow out of it, or you can stay there. I just, for me, it's like, it's more exciting to, like I said before, think of something, develop it, do it, and put it out in the world. Because I have so many of those things out in my head that the fastest I can get them out of my head, I can move to the next thing, you know? They're all colliding inside of my head all the time. So I need space. So the fastest I can, you know, be done with them without losing quality, without losing the conceptual part of it, without it being like a superficial cultural product. I always want to have some kind of sophistication happening. You know, it's not just an egocentrical, oh, I want to do 1,000 books. No, it's not about that. I do think there is a commitment and responsibility from putting books out into the world. So, but it's a balance, you know. It's exciting, but there is responsibility at the same time. Yeah.
Well, just long may it continue. Really, I'm. You're very inspiring and energizing to talk to, and I love to hear you talking. And you know, with such kind of passion and enthusiasm for photography and for bookmaking and for your practice, and thank you so much, Alejandro, for taking the time to speak to me. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity, and good luck with your endeavors for 2021. Yeah.